This is the Talking Tigers podcast, presented by Wickles Pickles. Look for Wickles Pickles at a grocery store near you and bring those tangy and fresh pickles to your home. Now, here's Andy Burcham with another Talking Tigers podcast.
Imagine never playing football until high school, getting a scholarship to play at Auburn, and starting as a freshman. That's the story of Tony Richardson. He started Auburn as a fullback, then played 17 years in the NFL. Tony grew up in a military family, and until high school, bounced back and forth from Germany and the United States. Football for Richardson until high school was soccer. For his 10 years in Kansas City, Richardson was inducted into the Chiefs Hall of Fame. He was named to the NFL Team of the 2000s, and in 2010 was named the Walter Payton Man of the Year. When his playing days ended, the NFL came calling. Richardson was asked to help retired players making the transition from the league. Tony Richardson is featured in this Talking Tigers podcast presented by Wickles Pickles.
Welcome to another edition of the Talking Tigers podcast presented by Wickles Pickles. We welcome in former Auburn fullback, former NFL All-Pro, now works with the NFL, Tony Richardson, to the Talking Tigers podcast. Very good to see you, Tony. How are things this day?
It's great. So great to see you. It's great to see another Auburn man. So it's going pretty good. Obviously, living in New York City, and our numbers were flat at one point as far as the pandemic. Now we're starting to slowly get a rise, and so we still have to keep our distance and be diligent about everything.
Tony, if you would just give us an idea. I mean, life here in Auburn, I wouldn't say that it's returned to normal, but folks are getting out a little bit and going out and having a bite to eat. We're over at Jordan-Hare Stadium with about 17,000 fans. What is life like in New York City through this pandemic?
Yeah, so interesting enough. So we'll get into it a little bit later. So I actually work for the National Football League, and my department's called Legends Community. So what we do, there's 27 guys that do exactly what I do. So my region, I'm the Northeast coordinator. So my two teams I work with are the Jets and Giants. So rewind, we actually had a conference in March, and it was in Vegas. So all the former NFL players, Orlando Pace, Will Shields, you name them, just, all the guys that do exactly what I do. And plus the team side. So, like Michelle Keys, what she does, from the team side, there's also a player in the liaison. So there's probably in each team, they probably have three or four people in the department that actually is dedicated to serving former players. And, everyone was a little nervous, and I was nervous as well. I remember, getting up that morning, and that's when we probably had in New York, we had about maybe 10 cases. I remember catching an Uber to the airport and going to JFK, and it felt like I was in a foreign country. Like, everyone was, because no one really knew. People were like, some people had on masks, some people were afraid, like, don't look at me, don't touch me, and all those kind of things. Get on the airplane, which is a four-hour flight to Vegas, and I'm just like, nervous. So that whole week, hotel, they were cleaning, and all of a sudden, we actually had a dinner that Wednesday night. That's when the first NBA player tested positive. And so all of a sudden, it was like, oh, NCAA's canceled, golf canceled. Everything just kind of was like a domino effect. And my travel agent, she booked my flight. She said, Tony, you got to get out of there because we just don't know what New York's going to look like. So we're going to get out. So I left that Thursday morning. I got back around midday Thursday night, and still just kind of like, okay, I don't want to get in the Uber. I don't want to get on the subway. I don't want to get in the cab. So I was kind of torn. I ended up taking a cab home, and the cab driver called 45 minutes all the way home. So, but anyway, from that day forward, New York was, it's still kind of like early. It's weird. I literally flipped. I have a dog, and so it's just me and Rambo. And so I literally flipped our schedule to the point to where only time I would go outside was just to walk in. Because, at one point, if you were keeping up with everything, we were having like 600 to 700 deaths a day, almost one day, almost 1,000. And so, and really not knowing, how the disease spread, we really just didn't have enough information. And so literally it was like living in a true bubble. And so now fast forward, our numbers are flat. We listen to the smarter people, we listen to them. And our numbers are pretty flat, but still to this day, no group fitness. So you can go to a gym, it's limited. There's no indoor seating restaurants at 25 capacity. Jets and Giants football. No fans in the stands. And so now it's starting to, you know, because, you know, one of those things, people now are starting to let their guards down a little bit, and our numbers are starting to kind of creep back up. So we, you know, we just, you know, for me personally, I'm still, you know, wearing my mask and I still keep my distance and trying to do the right thing.
Tony, I want to talk a little bit about your career. And I want to start with your time in Germany. You were born in Frankfurt. Your father was in the army. Yeah. So when was it that you played football for the first time? When were you first exposed to football?
Yeah, I kind of give you the fast track of a long story. So I was born in Frankfurt. We lived there for 2 years. We moved to El Paso, Texas. We lived there for 3 years. Back to Germany for 3 years. Fort Knox for 3 years when my dad was a drill sergeant. And then back to Germany. So through all of that, I never played football because, you know, in Europe, football is soccer. And so, you know, as a kid that, you know, I was kind of a kid that, you know, listened to AC/DC, had holes in my knees, was a skateboarder, bicycles and all those kind of things. And so I really didn't play organized sports just because it really wasn't something that was, you know, pretty prevalent growing up. So my first time really kind of getting into football, and it's funny, I just did this piece the other day. I work with an organization for anti-bullying, and I actually explained, I said, you know, the only reason I got into football is because I was tired of getting bullied because I was kind of a shorter stature kid, really hadn't grown into, didn't know I was going to be 6'2", now I'm 240, didn't know I was going to be that kid. So I got picked on quite a bit. So the only reason I actually went out for football was to, quote unquote, hang out with the cool kids. And so that's when we moved to Belleville, Alabama. And we had 23 kids on a football team. And, you know, if you have 23 on a football team, probably on 11 don't know what they're doing. So it was trial by fire. Like, I literally, you know, we had a great high school football coach by the name of Perry Swindle. And he had just arrived at Delville, which he was a godsend because he came in. He had a great weight program. He encouraged all the kids to, you know, play baseball, run track, all those kind of things. He said, Tony, if you work really hard, there's going to be a good chance that, you know, you potentially could get a football scholarship. And so, unfortunately, I went to Alabama's football camp in my 11th grade year. I don't hold that against me, Gene Scollins camp. And then I ended up going to 1989, Auburn versus Alabama. And Coach Dye offered me a scholarship, and I've never looked back since.
After not playing football through all that time, then what was that like to pick up the game at that point? Because, I mean, if you're playing 4 years of high school football, by the time you're done, you're being offered a scholarship to play college football. That's a remarkable transformation.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. So many people are like, man, you got to write a book, you know, one day. Because I tell kids all the time, it's like, and I think that's everything and how it applies to things in life. It's not where you start, it's how you finish. Because the first time, and I remember this like, yesterday, I remember they just said, hey, you know, I'm going out for the football team. They just put all this stuff in my locker. So I'm over there picking up stuff. I'm like, okay, I don't know what this is. <I don't know." laughs> So I had like my hip pad and my butt pad. All that stuff was mixed up and had no clue. And one guy, one of my teammates, he literally was like, okay, here, you know, and I was embarrassed because, you know, it's the South, so you can't play football. And I remember getting to, when I got to Delville, they were like, hey, who are you rooting for? I'm like, rooting for? They're like, what are you talking about? Who are you rooting for? I was like, he said, Alabama, Auburn. I said, Auburn. I said, okay. So I got that part right. I had no clue how to strap it on. So finally, I learned how to put the pads on. And funny enough, the first game that we played, we were on the 20-yard line. Because, you know, I had to play every position. So kickoff return, got it out to the 20. First carry I got was an 80-yard touchdown. I was like, wow, this is pretty easy. Now I know we're going to go 2-8 my senior year. But, but yeah, I said, this is pretty easy. You know, there's so many things that make up, you know, the story of Tony Richardson. So we were able to get stationed at Belleville because there's a military base there called Fort Rooker. And at that time, my grandmother, God rest her soul, she's passed now. She was extremely ill. And because of my dad's rank, he was a sergeant major. He was pretty much able to kind of ride his own ship toward the end of his career. Okay. And so we got stationed. My dad was more infantry, working with tanks and things like that. He's a Vietnam veteran, you know, Purple Heart. And Fort Rooker is an aviation base, helicopters, pilots, and all those kind of things. Nothing that was in his wheelhouse, but it was close enough to Panama City to where hour and a half, hour and 10 minutes, hour and 15 minutes, that we could get down there if we needed to. And so thankfully, you know, I got planted in Delville. But one part of my story that I think a lot of people really don't know is my junior year in high school, my dad, you know, before I went to school today, my dad said, hey, son, when you get home, me and your mother need to talk to you. So if you're from the South, you know what that means. I'm like, uh-oh, I've done something wrong. I didn't know what I had. I had a test that day. I didn't do well on it. football practice, I think I fumbled like three times just because mentally I wasn't there. Come home and my parents are sitting on the couch. They say, hey, son, sit down. And my dad says, hey, you know what? Me and your mother talk. I just got orders to go back to Germany. So I'm going to miss your senior year of high school and I'm going to miss your freshman year of college. And he said, we made this decision because, you know, at that time, you know, all the colleges, the Florida States, the, you know, Alabama, all these schools started coming around. And he said, son, we want you to be able to chase your dreams. And so I look back at my story and every opportunity I get, I always thank my parents because, you know, my dad could have been selfish and we could have packed up, left Belleville and went back to Germany. And, this story, Tony Richardson's story, and Auburn University, that because we weren't playing football, so that story wouldn't happen at all.
All right, so you go from one day where you don't even know what pads to put on, to another day where you become one of the very few true freshmen to start a college football game for Pat Dye at Auburn University. That's a remarkable time. Think about how many years was that from the time that first practice to the time that you're starting a college football game?
You know, it's one of those things, because I remember, like, you know, because I was a pretty decent, you know, I was a tailback in high school. And so I felt like, you know, I was pretty good. I was like, okay, you know, I knew we had Stacey Dantley. We had James Joseph. We had Alex Smith. We had Electron. James, we had all these running backs, you know, all running back you. And so get to the depth chart, and I'm looking at the depth chart. All of a sudden, my name is Bam. That's a Bob, T-Pop Brown. And so I was just, the only thing I knew was just to go full speed and hit everything moving. And so it got to the point where I literally was, you know, trying to knock people out of practice. And that time, you know, we had just come off, we had the number one ranked defense. I mean, Tracy Rocker, Corey Barlow, like, you know, all these guys. You know, it's one of those things. I just was out there just running around like a wild chicken. And one day Coach Dye said, hey, son, I don't know where you came from, but we're going to find a place for you to play. And so I started, he put me in. That's when I think Stacy got hurt and they moved Bo Pete to starting tailback. And I still was about three or four down in the fullback line. Slowly, practice after practice after practice, I just kept, you know, making improvements and learning the playbook. Coach Casey, God rest his soul, was really, I wouldn't say he was patient with me, but he was just kind of showing me the ropes. And he was just like, you know what, there's a place for you to play. And you just got to continue to keep working hard. And, you know, I got that knock on the door and starting as a freshman. And that, to me, still, you know, when you start looking at Bo Jackson starts as a freshman. Like Tony Richardson wasn't supposed to be in that narrative. So I'm very, very thankful to have an opportunity.
The influence that Coach Dye had, not only on you as a football player, but as an Auburn man, Tony, what was that?
It's everything. I mean, obviously, Pat Dye Jr., he was my agent, still a great friend of mine. It was just one of those things. And I think for me, and I think, you know, when we did our call, a lot of guys talked about that father figure. And so for me, you know, I had a father in my life, but here all of a sudden, my dad, during the most pivotal time of my life, when I had to make that decision, you know, me and my mom had to navigate. You know, my mom wasn't really educated in a way to where the coaches were coming to the house when the letters were coming. You know, I had to kind of figure that stuff out. Obviously, my high school coach was there, but I remember Coach Dye came to my house, and when he sat down with my mom, it was, you know, and obviously, Coach Daniels as well. It was just something like you just felt it was right. And you just knew, like, my mom knew that she can, this was like dad. It was like, I'm taking you from a young man and I'm going to pass you over and you're going to become a grown man. And, you know, the things that Coach Dye taught me, you know, both on and off the field, day in and day out. It was just the little things too. It was just like I mentioned on the call, like when I got to the National Football League, practice was easy. I'm like, man, this is all we're doing today. Because we worked so hard and the attention to detail was there. And it was just one of those things where, you know, if it wasn't for Coach Dye, I wouldn't be sitting here today and we wouldn't be having this call. So I have nothing but the most gratitude and thankfulness to Coach Dye and his family for giving me an opportunity.
Tony, I've asked Stan White the same question and this is his 20th year working with us on the Auburn Sports Network. So you go from Coach Dye and the end of his career at Auburn, Terry Bowden comes in, and you're part of a remarkable 1993, a magical season, that undefeated season in 93. And I know you guys don't get an opportunity to play for a conference championship or a national championship, but boy, that nothing can take away from what had to be just a tremendous, tremendous team to be a part of.
Yeah, it really was. And it was kind of a pivotal time because it was one of those things that, you know, obviously when you have because obviously we were just devastated, you know, when Coach Dye, when he stepped down. And then all of a sudden, you know, we have a new coach. And so, you know, when a new coach comes in, he wants his guys. And so we didn't really know. I mean, obviously, you knew Wayne Gainey was going to be a first rounder. You knew, you know, James Bostic, and they were still rotating. They were bringing Steven in. So I didn't really know. I'm like, man, I don't even know if I'm going to have a place on the team. I felt like I had played well enough. And I just went out and just put my nose down. And Coach Rodney Allison was, you know, really in my corner and really worked with us. And it was just one of those things. It's kind of we got off the call last night. And I think I might have talked to Ramon Luster for probably 2 hours just catching up, because it's that brotherhood. And it was one of those things, like, it was week in and week out. It was – we looked at it, it was us against the world, because no one gave us an opportunity. No one – believed in us. And it was like, you know, I think about the fourth down, the goal line stop at, you know, Vanderbilt, all those different things. And it was just like, we had that mentality, like, okay, we're on probation for something that we had no part of, especially my senior year. It was something that happened, you know, before we arrived. And, but yet still, we came together as a band of brothers, and we fought and we clawed. And I mean, I look back, you know, I still, obviously my favorite play is a block, you know, for Bostic. And he actually texted me this morning. You know, that's that play still just like, you know, because we had to beat Alabama. Like, we lost three straight years in a row. And I just remember, like, when I saw JB running, his head was back. And he probably was looking And I remember, like, man, it was just like a, I don't know, I still get goosebumps and chills now just thinking about, like, that year and what we were able to accomplish. And, you know, no one can ever take that away from us. Obviously, we didn't get the national, you know, national recognition, but we have that recognition from ourselves. And, you know, going through the SEC undefeated, you obviously, as you know, it's not very easy to do.
Tony's referred a couple times to a call, and at least this season on Mondays, we do a Zoom call with the Auburn football Letterman. And we have one of the Letterman that it's part of our call and the guys can, and Tony was part of it yesterday. But it's fun to see these guys that I've covered through my 30-some years here at Auburn now that are, you know, they've moved on, and some are still playing in the league. Some are not playing in the league like yourself, but have moved on to another career. There's a lot of dads, you know, that now have kids in college, which is hard to believe. But it is another example. But the brotherhood that you guys have, not only with the players that you played, but with the guys that came before you, the guys that have played since then, it is a unique fraternity, isn't it, of Auburn football players?
Yeah, it's nothing like it. And I know a lot of colleges, you know, you hear players from Ohio State, you hear players from Michigan, and they talk about, like, but I just think, and I'm obviously biased, but I just really feel like what we have at Auburn and what we've created, it's a brotherhood. And it's something that was the biggest thing, even though I was fortunate to move on to play the National Football League. Like, I miss my guys. I mean, think about, you know, in that college atmosphere, I got a chance to see 90 of my brothers every single day. And we cried together, we won together, we lost together, we ate together, like every last single thing you can possibly imagine. And you think about it, and just like, you know, you can never get those times back. And the thing that, yeah, do I miss Tiger Walk? You know, do I miss, you know, running out on down Pat Dye Field? Do I miss playing against Alabama? Yeah, but the thing I miss the most is just that camaraderie, just being with, you know, Reed McMillan, Stan White, you know, all these guys, like Harold Morrow, just, you know, Bostic, Gandy's. Like, you just think about all those memories and all the times we share together. And I, like I said, I'm biased, but it's nothing like it, because everywhere I go, whenever I travel on a plane, I always wear something Auburn. And it's not a time I go to any airport anywhere that someone didn't walk up to me and say War Eagle. Not even have a clue that I played ball or anything. Every airport I've gone to, there's even walking through Atlanta, I always see an Auburn shirt, and I'll make it a point and say War Eagle. Funny enough, I have a church right across my street. The pastor of the church, him and his wife went to Auburn, graduated in 1993.
How about that?
In Long Island City, New York. You can't even, I mean, literally, it's new church right out my window. And him and I were talking one day, and he got to talking, and he was like, yeah, I'm from the South. I said, where are you from? He said, I went to Auburn. I'm like, oh. And I'm like, I said, you went to Auburn? He's like, yeah. I said, what year did you graduate? He said, 93. I said, and he said, Tony Richardson. I said, yeah. And I'm like, you can't make this up. And it's just, I think I mentioned on our call that we have the Auburn Bar, which is on, it's called St. Patrick's. It's on 46 between 5th and 6th in Manhattan. Before the pandemic, on a game day, you'll have 100 to 200 Auburn former students and fans at this bar watching football weekend.
How about that?
It's unbelievable.
Could you have envisioned what your NFL career would be like? Because let's be honest, you had recognition coming out of college, but you were undrafted that first year with Dallas. And then that 10 years with Kansas City, and you're part of Pro Bowls, and then you move on to the Vikings and then to the Jets, and the Wizzer White NFL Player of the Year, the Walter Payton Man of the Year in the NFL, three Pro Bowls, all those guys that you blocked for that were 1,000-yard rushers, the Alabama Sports Hall of Fame in 2050. Boy, that's a lot for a guy from Daleville, Alabama, that didn't play football until he got into high school.
You know, sometimes you kind of have to just pinch yourself because you realize that, you know, because it was one of those things that I think for me personally, like, this wasn't something that I even dreamed about. I couldn't imagine. So I wasn't a kid that was in Germany. I'm like, man, one day I'm going to be in the National Football League, because no one had ever done that. So even when I got to Daleville, you know, I remember, like, when I started to have a little bit of success, you know, you hear the chatter. It's like, oh, you know, he'll be a, you know, pretty good, you know, high school football player, but he'll never make it. Because, I mean, we had 22 kids on my high school football team, 23, 110 kids in my graduation class, two traffic lights. I think there's three now in Daleville. So you start looking at that and you're like, man, how does this happen? And, you know, a lot of it, I look back and I look at mentorship. And when I got to Dallas, and it was funny, I remember when I didn't get drafted, it was very, very disappointing. And I remember Pat called me, Pat Dodd Jr., and he was just like, hey, Tony, you know what? He was very positive. He said, you know, this is going to be great. And I'm sitting here like, man, I'm disappointed. He's like, this is going to be great because now you're a free agent and you can kind of pick and choose, you know, what's the best situation for you. He's like, and we started looking around. He's like, I think you should go to Dallas. And I'm like, okay. Emmitt Smith, Darryl Johnson, Derek Lassick, Lincoln Coleman. Oh, yeah, and by the way, the backup fullback happens to be Tommy Agee, who's Emmitt Smith's best friend. So I'm like, I gotta beat Tommy Agee out to make the roster. Yeah. And Tommy took me from day one. He took me under his wing, taught me the playbook. Jason Garrett, like, they literally taught me everything I needed to know. And think about it, Tommy's later in his career, and you get this young fullback from Auburn who was crazy and didn't know any better, running around hitting everything, moving. And he took me under his wing and showed me the ropes, and basically said, "Hey, you know, stick with me, stick with Emmitt. If you listen, you'll have a pretty good career." And I end up, you know, staying on practice squad that year. And then obviously having those Hall of Famers around me, then I landed in Kansas City. And I tell this story all the time. So I had, at the time, I had number 49. So it was a number 32 and it was a number 42. 32 was Marcus Allen. 42 was Ronnie Lott. And I'm like, okay. And I'm sitting in the locker room. I'm like, yeah, I think I'm just going to shut my mouth for the whole training camp. And, you know, you just look at it. You look at that, you know, the mentorship. And obviously, you know, I was, I eulogized Derek Thomas when he passed away. And DT was my, he was my host when I took my official visit to Alabama. Mm. So all of a sudden I get there and I got, you know, I'm looking at, man, this is Derek Thomas. Like, I don't think there was a greater linebacker to me, arguably in the history of college football, than Derek Thomas. And these guys literally they opened their arms and showed me the ropes and just kind of, you know, taught me to do the right things, how to take care of your body on and off the field, all those good things. And, you know, 17 years later.
Wickles Pickles is proud to be the new sponsor of the Talking Tigers podcast. From Saturday sandwiches to Thanksgiving dinner, that secret 90-year-old recipe has people from all over calling to get some of those sweet and spicy jars. Look for Wickles Pickles at a grocery store near you and bring those tangy and fresh pickles to your home. Made fresh in Dadeville, Alabama. For a guy that played 10 years in Kansas City, and your career blossomed in Kansas City, what was it like then to see the Chiefs win the Super Bowl last year?
Yeah, so, you know, now working for the National Football League, I guess it comes with a little bit of perks. And so last year, the commissioner, Roger Goodell, you know, we travel together quite a bit, or we do a lot of speaking engagements. So he calls me up and he's like, hey, Tony, I got two tickets to the AFC Championship game in Kansas City. And I'm like, well, when are you flying down? He's like, well, I'm leaving on Sunday. And I'm like, okay, so that means you're flying private. So, so if you leave it on Sunday and the game is at, what, 1 o'clock? I said, he's like, yeah, I'd like you to be my guest. And so I end up, you know, I took my buddy Donnie Edwards, a longtime linebacker. And so we end up flying down. And it was just one of those things where I was sitting in the suite, and we had some Chiefs Hall of Famers in the suites as well. And it was like the only thing, one of the main goals we always wanted to do was to be able to present, you know, Mr. Hunt, Lamar Hunt, with his trophy that bears his name, because right, when you win the AFC Championship, it's the Lamar Hunt trophy. And just when that final clock went down and the confetti started falling, tears just started running down my face. Because that same thing, you know, how Coach Dye and what he meant to me in my life pretty much my entire life, Lamar Hunt was that same person, was the, you know, the guy who came up my, you know, my first year in Kansas City in 1995. I was like, hey, how's your sister doing, Sean? I'm like, hold up. I'm a first year old in roster. Like, how do you even know I have a sister? How do you know my name? Mm-hmm. And just like one of those things, when I went back and I got my MBA from Webster University in Kansas City, you know, Mr. Hunt came to the graduation. They had like a little VIP private section. He drove himself there. No one could find him. He's sitting at the top of he's in the rafters, you know, up there just hanging out with all the families. And so to be able to see them have that, be able to present the trophy, and then fast forward, was at the Super Bowl. And so Taquio Spikes and I, I was fortunate to land this deal to do the pregame show for ESPN, well, NFL Network, actually. And so they were like, hey, man, you know, we would love to get a San Francisco 49er. I was like, you know anybody? I'm like, do I know anybody? I'm like, yeah, how about Taquio Spikes? He's like, you know Taquio Spikes? I'm like, you know, went to Auburn. So Taquio and I actually went early. We went to the game probably 3 hours early, and we did the entire pregame. It was shown throughout the entire stadium.
Yeah.
And afterwards, we're both sitting there like, I'm in Chiefs gear. He's in San Francisco gear. And we were like, bro, you know what? I don't think we want to stay at this game, because there was no way possible that we were going to be able to sit in the stands and be able to enjoy the game, just because, you know, just cheap stuff on, Auburn stuff, I mean, San Francisco stuff on. So him and I booked it back to the hotel. We changed. Him and I sat down, grabbed some dinner, and watched the game together. And we had a little friendly wager. Obviously, we the Chiefs ended up pulling out. But it's still, you know, that was the biggest thing, just because you saw what the Hunt family meant to Kansas City and how hard all these players that have come before me and the ones that come after, that's the only thing we want to do, is to be able to present Mr. Hunt with a trophy. And now it's back in Kansas City.
I have a friend that went to Kansas City on business and was there. It was December or January, and he got a ticket to a Chiefs game.
Wow.
And he said, I know how loud Jordan-Hare Stadium can get. But he said, I've never heard anything like what Arrowhead Stadium was like when the Chiefs are playing there. Yeah. Can you verify that?
Yeah, there's been some times before where I literally felt my heart skip a beat. it's something special. And it's funny because it's like, you know, you start looking at, like when I first came to the league, Seattle was that, they had the indoor stadium. That's what Seattle, which is crazy. They were in the AFC West. And they had some kind of noisemakers. And it was like ridiculously loud. Like for you, it's like, this shouldn't even be fair. But then all of a sudden now, when Arrowhead, and obviously we started having success, on third down, Derek Thomas coming off the edge. I mean, we played Seattle 1 year. He had 7.5 sacks in one game, which, because the offensive tackle couldn't even get out of his stance fast enough. He couldn't even hear the snap count. So you look at that, obviously now Seattle is probably neck and neck with Kansas City. But it's a special place. When the fans are really rocking, it's something like you've never heard. But I'm still going to kind of argue, though, because, you know, and it was funny because when I went to Dallas and leaving Auburn, you know, Dallas is all corporate. Everyone's sitting there, you know, make sure that everything's perfect. And it was like you could hear a church mouse from leaving Auburn. And then when I got to Kansas City, I was like, okay, now we're back to really football. this is what I grew up in Auburn. But in Dallas, like, everyone's sitting and people are clapping, like, you know, at Auburn, no one's sitting down the entire game. So I would compare Auburn and Kansas City to be about neck and neck.
There's a lot of accolades that go with you, as mentioned, the Wizard White Man of the Year in 2010, the Walter Payton Player of the Year in 2010, Kansas City Chiefs Hall of Fame. You were part of the All-Decade Team in the NFL in the 2000s, Alabama Sports Hall of Fame in 2015. When you look back on that, Tony, what does that mean for those kind of accolades to be going with your name?
You know, every speech, because obviously, you know, you get those opportunities, you have to make a speech. And every time I do it, obviously my parents are sitting right there in front. And it's just like one of those things, like when I got inducted to the Chiefs Ring of Honor, I couldn't even finish the speech. Like literally it was interesting because Priest Holmes actually did this to me. He got kind of choked up. And he was like, hey, T-Rich, can you come up here and just kind of say a few words? I'm like, dude, it's your night. Why you got me up here? And then when the table was turned, you know, I called Priest up because I couldn't even keep it together, because I look at my parents and they were everything to me and giving me that opportunity. And I tell young people all the time, it's like, you know, it's great if your parents can afford to give you a new car, to give you new shoes, give you all that stuff. But the time they spend and the time they pour into you and the sacrifices they make, you know, like I said, if my dad and my mom said, okay, yeah, we don't want to be separated for a year and a half, 2 years, we're all going back to Germany. Everyone else is out of the house. It would have just been, you know, me and my parents, and they would have been, not say, it wouldn't even, that's not even being selfish. That's just part of life. And if they didn't make that sacrifice, then it would be, none of that stuff would be possible. So like I said, I still think I'm living a dream, because a little kid from Delville is not supposed to be accomplishing those things and having those opportunities. But obviously it started with Auburn and having my parents and having Coach Dye and, you know, having guys like Rodney Garner, who was on our call, and, you know, James Daniels and all those, Coach Witt, all those mm-hmm. late night talkings and, all those conversations that really paid off in my life.
All right. Your pro career, your NFL career comes to a close 10 years ago. How did you take that step then to go to work for the NFL? How did that take place, Tony?
It's one of those things, because I was in year 17 and we were playing against the Pittsburgh Steelers. And the year before, we had made it to the AFC Championship game and we fell short. And so I was like, you know what? And we had Rex Ryan. And that year before, we were on Hard Knocks. The whole, like, all of my year where I thought I was about to get cut was documented. So thank you, HBO. But so the following year, we were like, okay, we're going to, you know, basically try to do it again. We kept everyone intact. You know, we brought in LaDainian Tomlinson. We had Damian Woody. We had all these guys, Adam Fanick. We had all these guys. We were like, okay, we're going to make another run at it. And so we make it to the AFC Championship game again, and we're playing against the Pittsburgh Steelers. It was kind of one of those things going into that game, and it was in Pittsburgh. And you kind of start thinking about, okay, we're at the end of the road. Obviously, it would have been great, because in my mind, I was like, okay, if we beat Pittsburgh, the Super Bowl this year is going to be in Dallas. I'm like, how great would this be to be able to start in Dallas, finish in Dallas, and maybe win a ring? And so we end up losing the game. I think we lost by, you know, a few points, came up short. And, you know, and it's the finality, because, you know, Mike Tomlin had just got the head coaching job with the Steelers, and he was our defensive coordinator when I was with the Vikings. So him and I had built, and we're close in age, so we built a great relationship. So I'm trying to go over to shake his hand. They pushing me out of the way. That's one thing you don't want to be a part of. They're pushing it. The confetti's falling. The stage is coming out. Wiz Khalifa's on. I'm like, to this day, I don't like Wiz Khalifa, because he's singing that song Black and Yellow. And it's the finale. And like, all of a sudden, it's like they're pushing you out of the way. And like, the stage is coming. I didn't get a chance to go congratulate him. And I remember just, you know, sitting in my locker and put my head down. And it's just like everything I knew it was over. And tears came, and then I knew it was over. Rex had called me up. He was like, hey, what do you think? And I was like, because I already knew, because the chance of going to three AFC championship games. But, you know, it's one of those things that you just know it's going to be pretty difficult. And I have to admit, it was a struggle. I mean, even though I finished my undergrad at Auburn, had my MBA, had a lot of stuff kind of set up, that first year and a half was very difficult, because it's one of those things that even though you know you're prepared, you're really not prepared, because you just, like, all of a sudden, it's like I've been on a schedule, and obviously I mentioned at Auburn, we had 4 days. So I was on a schedule in Dallas, like every last single day of every minute of every day has been calculated. Okay, Monday, you got to be here. Tuesday is your community day. You got to be here. You got to be here Wednesday, boom, 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 all the way. You get 1 day off. In the off season, you get 2 weeks off. So for 17 years and plus Auburn, I just never had a free schedule. And then that day when it's over, you go to your exit physical that next day on that Tuesday, you're like, man, what are you looking around? Like, what am I going to do? And it struggled. So I actually struggled probably for about a year and a half. I kind of isolated myself and kind of like, just like most guys do, you kind of go into like a little shell or a little hole, and you're just trying to like, even though I kind of figured out what I wanted to do. And so the NFL started calling. And I, at that time, funny enough, so that was 2011, and I was on the executive committee that negotiated the CBA. And so then we had a lockout. So I wasn't in any kind of shape to play anyway, because, you know, we didn't know if we were going to have football. I was traveling, doing negotiations and all that. So I knew I wasn't in football shape. And so I was kind of tired of it from the standpoint of, like, when you sit in those meetings, you see all the stuff that happens from the union side and from the league side. I was like, you know what? I just want to be done with it. I just I didn't want anything to do with it. So the NFL was calling. They were calling. They were calling. I wasn't answering. So finally, probably about two years, I took the call, and they were like, hey, would you just come in and just kind of, we got a new position open, just see if there's something you'd be interested in. And I blew it off for like probably a month or so. And even before that, Andy Reid had actually offered me a job in Kansas City, crazy enough. So Coach Reid came to Kansas City, and he offered me the player development job. I turned that down. I just really wasn't, and mentally I wasn't really there for that position. And so I ended up going, you know, funny enough, where I live in New York, it takes me two stops on the E train straight to the NFL office. So I took the meeting, and they convinced me, they sold me, and basically it was just, we got this program now called Legends Community, And it's more so just taking care of the former players. And I was like, okay, so if I take care of this guy, who's going to get the credit? And they were like, you know what, this is one position that no one cares who gets the credit because it's about taking care of the man. And so I was like, okay, I could be a part of that because that's one thing I want to do is be in a position to serve and to be able to help people. And now I've been on the job for about 5.5 years. And, you know, I talk to guys about a 401k or annuity or severance, dental plans, internships, like anything that has to do with that transition. And it's funny enough, I have guys that, you know, been out of football 25, 30 years and they're still transitioning. They're not running 40s because we still have those guys 2 years later. I'm like, hey, man, what are you doing, man? I'm training. I'm like, what are you training for? A triathlon? He's like, no, I'm coming back. I'm like, nah, bro, it's been 2 years. That ship is sailed. But yeah, that's what moves the needle in my life now, just making sure our former players are well taken care of and healthy and, you know, and can move on to the next phase of their life.
You've always been that kind of guy. You've helped others, whether it was a fullback, so you're up always helping the tailback. You're getting a hole for the tailback. I know that you did a lot of community work when you played in the NFL. And now you're helping other guys that are transitioning and helping them with their retirement years. Where did that yearning to help others, where did that come from, Tony?
Yeah, it started from day one. Because I look at my dad and it's like, you know, you talk about a superhero. Like, you imagine as a young kid, and I used to just, all I want to do is get up early in the morning just to see my dad put his uniform on. And he put those boots on, and he's already a tall man. He's 6'3" with those boots on. He looks like 6'5". And he's like one of those things. To see him put that uniform on every last single day, you know, days when he'd have to go to the field, and my mom would be at the house, and I'm the youngest of 7, pulling everything together. The respect that I saw everywhere we went, like all his soldiers, the salutes, and like, Sergeant Major Richardson, like all those kind of things. And so, and I tell people this, I remember there were days we'd have Thanksgiving dinner and I would look over, there's 6 people at the table. I had no idea who they were. And it was just one of those things. My parents, as they instilled that at an early age, just about, you know, giving back and helping others. And obviously my sister, she followed in my dad's footsteps. She did 28 years, four deployments. And so you just kind of see that spirit of serving, you know, when my dad served our country and got up every single day, never complained, never was late. You know, you can't be late in the military. So you kind of see those kind of things. And my dad always used to say, he's like, son, you know what? Whatever you do, every time you, and he would say, you guys can bicker, you can fight, you can argue in this house. But when you leave this house, make sure you always represent the richest name and make sure you do the right things and make sure you help other people. So we were young and, you know, my dad would send us over and like, go cut the neighbor's yard. I'm like, they got a lawnmower? Like, why are you sending me over to cut it? And my dad was just like, go take the neighbor's trash out. I'm like, I got to do our stuff and then I got to do their stuff. But, you know, it's just one of those things. It's like, and now, you know, that's the thing I think that unfortunately our society sometimes a little bit is lost because even to this day, it's yes, sir, no, sir, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am. You know, if I see someone, I'm going to hold the door. It was funny when I moved to New York. I remember holding the door for someone. They look like they want to hit me with a baseball bat. They were like, hey, what are you doing? I'm like, dude, I'm just trying to hold the door before you. Like, hey, dude, I'm from the South. Like, this is what we do. But it's just one of those things. It's just a service of, you know, giving of yourself. And my dad always say it's 365, 7 days a week. What are you going to do with yours? And my pastor would say, and this is one thing I always like to, you know, think. Pastor would say, hey, son, and my pastor would call me son. He's like, always live your life with a dash. And he said, the dash, he said, so whenever you were born in 1971, those are going to be big numbers on the front. And whenever you know, go on to be with the Lord, there's going to be big numbers in the back. The smallest number on your tombstone is going to be his dash. But that's the most important because that's what you did. It's like, what do you want people to say that, what was Tony Richardson's dash? And so you think about it, it's like, does it wear you down sometimes? And now everything's obviously slowed down. But, you know, one point in time in Kansas City, I think I set a record. I did like 380 community service events in 1 year. It's like 365 days in a year. But it's kind of one of those things. It's like, if you have the time, and you are able, you know, you can give up your tithe, your time, your talents. So if you have the time, you know, give it. And you just never know that one person that, you know, could be having a bad day. If you say, hey, how you doing? That person could be on the verge of, you know, maybe taking their life or maybe just needs a pick me up or just needs a helping hand. And you just never know when you're going to be able to make a difference in someone's life.
All right. Final question here. What did Auburn mean to Tony Richardson? What does Auburn mean for Tony Richardson now?
Yeah, what Auburn did mean to me was taking a young kid. It's funny, a young kid. I remember this when Coach Daniels walked into my basketball game. for the first time. I saw him decked out in Auburn. I was just blown away. And it was just like, man, I can't believe that Auburn University is coming to watch me play basketball. And Auburn, what it meant to me was everything. Like it, you know, Auburn gave me that opportunity. It took a young, snotty-nosed little kid from Belleville, Alabama, 205 soaking wet on a good day, and turned me into a man. And that's one thing that I'm proud to say, that I'm an Auburn man. And that's something that, you know, that no one can ever take away from me. And what it means for me today is just, it's a level of pride. You know, I had a chance to meet Tim Cook at one of the Auburn games. And I look at all the great people. I mean, I took Charles Barkley to dinner. Actually, I took Charles Barkley to yoga in New York. And I got him for his story. I got him some yoga shorts and a yoga mat. And I brought everything till we had a steak dinner the night before. The only thing that fit Charles was the yoga mat. The shorts didn't fit. He had basketball shorts on. He talked all the way through the class. But, you know, it's just one of those things. That, you know, what Auburn means to me is it's a level of pride. I'm proud to be an Auburn man. I'm glad that the legacy is still there. When I look at all the coaches, former players that are back on staff, that we're going to be in good hands for a number of years. And, you know, so I'm proud to be an Auburn man, and it's everything to me in my life.
Thank you for telling your story today. I certainly appreciate that. I wish you nothing but the best. And I can't wait till we get to talk again. War Eagle.
War Eagle.
For Tony Richardson and the Talking Tigers podcast, presented by Wickles Pickles, I'm Andy Burcham. Be strong and be courageous. War Eagle.